it is really remarkable that, you know, here we are in the first year of Trump, the president who threatened to tank the entire UN system, and yet he is coming to the General Assembly really, really needing UN diplomacy to work over the Korean issue because the alternative is a war.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Sharon Weinberger, executive editor for News, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington today, and I'm joined remotely by Richard Gowan and Foreign Policy's Colm Lynch. Richard is a non-resident fellow at New York University's Center on International Cooperation. His research focuses on peacekeeping, multilateral security arrangements, and the relationship between the UN and the EU. Formerly manager of the European Program at the Foreign Policy Center, he is also a policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And Colm is FP's UN-based senior diplomatic reporter. ER fans, we love hearing from you. If you have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. So the big news this week is the 193-member United Nations, which is convening this week for the annual General Assembly of Speeches and High-Level Meetings. It's always a pretty interesting event, but I think particularly this year, all eyes are certainly on President Donald Trump. Colm, there was already an event that Trump made some remarks at that raised some eyebrows today, Monday. Can you talk a little bit about that? What did Trump have to say, and who was there with him?
Well, he had this was basically his first, you know, the first glimpse that anybody has had of Trump at the UN since he's become president. So there was a lot of focus on it. But he was basically hosting an event designed to promote UN reform by the Secretary General. But really, it was an opportunity to just give him a stage to be presidential and to meet with other world leaders. Of course, this was a meeting where the other world leaders didn't get to talk, you know, on the same format. I mean, there were 10 other countries that were there, and they weren't given speaking slots. So there's only Trump and the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and Nikki Haley, his ambassador, who gave speeches. But it was kind of interesting because, you know, in a way, the president's been getting criticized for not focusing enough on the UN. For, you know, we've been reporting a lot about how the State Department has kind of been reducing its, you know, presence at the UN, not quite as focused on UN issues. And he came with this very impressive delegation, but also notable for one reason. So he was joined by Nikki Haley, of course, by H.R. McMaster, his national security advisor, and James Mattis, his defense minister. But Rex Tillerson, his secretary of state, you know, who was supposed to be running American diplomacy, was nowhere to be seen. And I don't know. I know he's in town, but it's not clear why he wasn't there.
I mean,
that was kind
striking,
of,
right?
Kind of interesting.
Unusual.
Well, I mean it's unusual, like, historically, in terms of the role that the Secretary of State plays in overseeing, you know, the production of policy on the United Nations, but it's not so unusual in this administration. I mean, in a sense, Nikki Haley has kind of, I don't know if you can say she's cut Tillerson out of the UN business, but I don't think Tillerson has shown that much interest himself in being, you know, deeply engaged in UN affairs. So, you know, a while back, several weeks ago, she led a delegation of UN Security Council ambassadors, and they had a lunch with President Trump at the White House. And, you know, not only was Tillerson not consulted on the substance of that meeting, he didn't show up. And it's almost sort of unthinkable that sort of arrangement would happen, that the Secretary, you know, of State wouldn't be kind of a central player in all this.
Right. It's sort of the where's Rex theme that we've been revisiting at a number of previous podcasts and in some of our articles, this idea that he's just sort of missing in action at some key moments.
Yeah. So he's once again missing in action. But I suspect he'll be back. I mean, right. You know, one of the interesting things he's going to be doing is later he looks to be having a meeting on the Iranian nuclear program, where he could end up at the same table with the Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif. That'll be interesting. It'd be the first time that this administration's top diplomat has met with the Iranians. We had a lot of that in the previous one.
And Trump's remarks today, it's a real estate came up briefly in his remarks today, right?
Yeah. I mean, he basically was largely on his best behavior today, right? So he read from the script, he talked about, I mean, it was a real contrast to the election campaign where he's very critical of the UN. This time he was talking about, you know, what a great place it is and what value he places in the UN. But in terms of the value of the UN, you know, he went off script for a moment at the beginning and said, I know this like from personal experience, because this beautiful luxury residential building that I erected right across the street, which, you know, cast a shadow over the UN headquarters, wouldn't have succeeded as well as it had if it hadn't been for the United Nations, you know, existing. And so that was kind of a nice way to sort of include.
Oh, so he gave the UN credit for helping his hotel.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was good fun.
So to seem more serious, Richard, in terms of what other leaders coming to the General Assembly are looking for, what do you think their expectations are for Trump?
Well, I think Trump is lucky because expectations are fairly low. So as long as he behaves basically like a normal president and gives a moderately sensible speech and doesn't go off script, everyone will be reassured. I mean, it's been funny in the run-up to the General Assembly. I think media people, commentators like me, have been secretly hoping that Trump will pull a Gaddafi and give a 90-minute rambling address to the General Assembly, because of course that would be entertaining. But for most presidents, most diplomats attending the General Assembly, they desperately want to see Trump look normal. And I think he seems to be on track to do that. As Colin said, his appearance at this UN reform meeting today was pretty standard stuff. I think you could have got most US presidents to use most of the lines that Trump rolled out. And if he stays on script tomorrow for his major speech at the General Assembly, he may come away from New York looking marginally more like a sane leader than normal.
Colm, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think he will. I mean, there are asks out there. So there are countries that want him to do things, like they would like him to show more flexibility on Iran nuclear program, to signal that he's not going to completely try to ditch the Iranian nuclear agreement. And so there have been a lot of public statements about that. There have been efforts to get him to kind of back off on climate change, to show some sign that he might come back into agreement with the Paris Agreement on climate. And there is a hope that he would soften the position, wouldn't be too hard and too belligerent on North Korea. I mean, there is broad support for the Americans taking a tough position on North Korea until you get to a discussion of military force. So I think there's a lot of concern, from both friendly countries like Germany and France, and kind of traditional rivals like China and Russia, that the Americans kind of pursue some sort of diplomatic approach to dealing with the North Koreans. So it's not clear that they will get what they want, but I think that, you know, what everybody's hoping and wishing for is that they get some signal, to borrow a quote from Richard, that they move away from, you know, the America First Fund of the campaign and get back into some serious diplomacy. So this is really an effort across the board to try and press Trump to embrace multilateralism and to not kind of reject it offhand.
I mean, I would add there that everyone assumes that Trump is going to have a few tough lines for the UN. So he's going to call out the UN for bias towards Israel. That's inevitable. He's going to grumble about the cost and the bureaucracy of the UN system. That's something he's already touched on today. But most other leaders are just going to sit back and let that wash over them. Because, as Colm says, what they really want to hear is some moderation on Korea, some moderation on Iran, and some hint that Trump could find a way to keep the Paris Climate Change Treaty going for the U.S. One thing that I think is interesting is that this is not the age of Eisenhower or Kennedy. This is the age of social media. So all Trump needs to do is throw out a few zingers at the U.N., which Breitbart and others can then take out of context and retweet. And that will satisfy his base in the U.S. And then the rest of the speech can be given over to more standard diplomatic talk.
Yeah, well, that's actually, Colm, I was looking back at the article you wrote. It wasn't you. It's Joshua Keating wrote for Foreign Policy in 2009 about the top 10 craziest things ever said during a U.N. speech. And what's interesting is it was in some ways, it appears it's more of an opportunity for non-U.S. leaders to sort of make a big point. It doesn't seem like there's a history of U.S. presidents sort of making sort of t- totally out there statements. I mean, do you think Trump will take this opportunity, or are we looking in the wrong direction? Are there other countries that may sort of try to steal the limelight on this?
Well, I think, I mean, will you get another, you know, head of state walking up to the podium and saying, it smells like sulfur here, which was what Hugo Chavez said after following George W. Bush to the podium and then saying that he had basically had taken the spot of comparing him to Satan. So, you know, might there be something like that on Trump? Yeah, there very well might be. I mean, it'd be interesting. I mean, the Iranian president, you know, is fairly, I don't think you're, you know, he's not Ahmadinejad, their previous president. So I would expect him to be more restrained. But, you know, there's still, you know, there's still some leaders who might, you know, I don't know, even if Robert Mugabe, you can always count on him for saying something particularly outrageous and critical, often focus on the British, but the Americans as well. So you might get a couple of, you know, of zingers coming from, you know, some other countries. But I think there will also be a lot of veiled criticism of the United States. I was at a press conference this morning with the French foreign minister, and he was talking in sort of general terms about, you know, the sort of degradation of the geostrategic kind of environment of today and how it's never been worse since the Cold War, and sort of talking about, you know, criticizing indirectly countries that are sort of withdrawing from the international, you know, system for what he characterizes fear or perhaps selfishness. So there's going to be a lot of that. There's going to be a lot, I think, of veiled shots at Trump, but they're not necessarily going to take him on head on. But, you know, you can always hope that there's going to be something controversial to cover.
Well, speaking of which, so Trump's big speech is going to be Tuesday morning. You know, this is a president who has, you know, he's cut back the delegation for this event. He's been very critical of multilateral agreements, of multilateralism in general. He's been a critic of the nuclear pact with Iran, which is coming up for certification. I mean, basically a critic of a lot of things that the UN sort of in many ways stands for. Richard, what do you think will be Trump's message in the speech tomorrow?
Well, as I say, I think he will have some tough lines for the UN, knowing that his base and the right-wing media will be watching for some red meat. My sense overall, though, is that it's going to be a fairly balanced talk, as long as he stays on script. And of course, no one can ever guarantee that he will stay on script. I think that he will lay out criticisms of the UN. He will tell the UN what he wants from it, which most obviously and most urgently includes continued support in the Security Council for pressure on North Korea. But then he will offset that by talking about how he does want the organization to work. And Trump has a long history, going back to the 1990s, of grumbling about the UN, but also saying that he believes it's an organization with great potential. That's another line that we've heard again today. And I think that he will focus on this idea that if the UN works for the US, then he will support the organization and he will stick with international cooperation. And, you know, that's a line you can sell as America first. But it's also a line that is reassuring for other leaders. I doubt it will be a hugely inspirational speech. I think it will be quite transactional. You know, you help me, I'll help you. And there are other leaders here who I think will attempt to outplay Trump by bringing some inspiration to the party. Most obviously, Emmanuel Macron of France, who speaks for a couple of hours after Trump and will almost certainly play the anti-Trump, talking about his passion for global governance. You know, so other leaders will probably have better shows and possibly better lines than the president. But what most of the audience diplomatically in New York want to hear is Trump saying, we can get along.
You know what I think is kind of interesting is that, you know, we're talking a lot about, you know, this is obviously Trump's debut. And, you know, how is he going to be seen on the world stage? What I also think is interesting is that kind of like a kind of side story to this is Nikki Haley and to what degree. I mean, in a sense, this is also her debut. And it really, I think, in some way reflects more of her approach to foreign policy than even the president. So, you know, the president doing a kind of high level hosting a big meeting on UN reform. I mean, it's not something that I think he spends a lot of time, you know, late at night thinking about. But that's an area that, you know, Haley has picked as an area that she is going to be focused on. She's been focused on trying to reduce funding and sort of money, U.S. taxpayer money for peacekeeping missions. She has some successes on that, getting, you know, something like, you know, $500 million of the peacekeeping budget cut out by, you know, sort of the closure of some of the key peacekeeping missions. She is really kind of, you know, seems to be the diplomatic voice who is going to be heard most loudly this week beyond Trump, in the sense that, you know, we're not seeing a lot of Tillerson. And that's kind of was also another interesting thing. Like, why wasn't Tillerson at this event that she had organized, which I thought was kind of interesting. So, I mean, it's an opportunity for her to help develop her own diplomatic brand. There's a lot of talk about her as a possible successor for Tillerson as Secretary of State. She doesn't have a lot of experience, but she's done a fairly good job of promoting her brand and her position, and has kind of emerged as one of the more popular voices on foreign policy in the administration. So I think that's kind of interesting, too.
But I think Haley has to be really careful, though, Colin, because there have been a couple of occasions where she's been described in the press as presidential material over the course of the last year. And each time that comes up, there's quite a lot of briefing back from the White House, putting her back in her box. And I think that if Trump comes away from New York thinking that he's been overshadowed by Haley, that will make their relations very difficult from here on. She does have to temper her star power and play the good and faithful servant to the president, or her access to the White House could suddenly become quite problematic.
Yeah, Trump. I mean, Trump did have that. He did have that great line where, when she brought the UN Security Council ambassadors to New York, I mean to Washington for the lunch, like in the middle of the meeting, Trump asked all the other delegates there. She said, "Is she doing a good job?" And they all say, "Oh yeah, she's doing a great job." He goes, "Okay, well if she isn't, let me know because I could get rid of her."
But that's, you know, Colm, I wanted to ask about that because, you know, so many of other of Trump's picks have sort of seen his wrath at some point. You know, Tillerson is certainly on the outs. McMaster, it seems like it's been up and down. You know, Jeff Sessions, we all know what's gone on there. Or maybe not Mattis at the Pentagon, but I mean, what is the relationship between Nikki Haley and Trump? Because for the most part, he hasn't really directed a lot at her in terms of that he has at other cabinet members or other appointees. Do they enjoy a fairly good relationship?
It's interesting because in the beginning of the administration, I mean, when Tillerson came in, everybody made a big deal out of like the fact that he took like something like two lunches a week or something with Trump. And that was an indication of how close and intimate the relationship was. And and Haley was not, you know, she was someone who had criticized him during the campaign and not seen as someone who would be a natural kind of member of the inside circle. The inner circle. But you know, I think she's done a good job. She's cultivated, I mean, recently, I don't know. I mean, she's done a good job of like cultivating a close relationship with McMaster. She's also tried to cultivate other allies in the inner circle. She's been working closely over the last couple of months with Ivanka Trump and trying to find issues that might interest Ivanka Trump. Initially, Ivanka Trump was looking at the possibility of kind of associating herself, you know, visiting some, you know, refugee camps or, you know, IDP camps where people were suffering from hunger and that sort of thing. So there were some discussions at the beginning. She was introducing Ivanka to people at the World Food Program to look for opportunities. I hear that Ivanka has now kind of pull back from that because doesn't see that as a sort of winning political issue for them and might draw too much of a contrast between the fact that the White House is trying to cut humanitarian aid and, you know, seeing her as trying to kind of, you know, become, you know, one of the administration's voices on that. But I think she's done a good job of, on the one hand, cultivating the right allies. She's also, I think, done a good job of keeping Congress at bay on the funding issues. They wanted to really cut the hell out of the budget, and I think she's worked closely with people, appropriators like Senator Lindsey Graham, and others to try and get them to back off a little bit. And, you know, and one of the, you know, things that might play to her benefit is she's not in Washington, and for some reason she seems to be, you know, avoiding some of the pitfalls that a lot of her colleagues have fallen into. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about some of the specific issues. There was at least one report out that perhaps Trump wouldn't pull out of the Paris Agreement, but then the White House pushed back on that very hard. What was going on with that?
My sense is that that could have been the White House deliberately throwing out some slightly misleading stories. I think that it's clear that Trump's withdrawal from Paris, or at least his announcement that he will withdraw from Paris, has backfired horribly. I mean, he's united the entire UN against him. No other country has announced that it will also pull out. And it is clear that there's going to be a lot of coded criticism of the U.S. from other leaders this week in New York for this decision. So I would suspect that some people in the administration thought that they would create some confusion, create some uncertainty, suggest that maybe the U.S. could stay in the deal, because that means that other leaders, leaders like Macron from France, will have to temper their implicit criticism of the U.S. a little bit. So it may just be some very useful diplomatic noise.
Colm, did you have thoughts on that?
No, not really. I think Richard summed it up pretty good.
The other thing that's coming down the pike very quickly is the 90-day recertification for Iran being in compliance with the nuclear agreement. And as you, I think, Colm, you wrote about, Tillerson is expected to meet with his counterpart this week. There does seem like that Trump really wants to decertify Iran. Ambassador Haley kind of came out and made the case for that in Washington a couple weeks ago. Where do you see that going?
That's the million-dollar question this week, isn't it? I mean, I'm trying to make sense of, you know, there was a recent decision by President Trump. He had an opportunity to reimpose congressional sanctions on Iran, and he didn't do it. And that was sort of an indication that, you know, they were trying to avoid a confrontation. I mean, as Richard said, they've been very much isolated on climate, and they are going to be isolated on Iran. So I'm sure that, my understanding is that national security advisors are trying to get him to back off of the precipice on this and to find some way through that doesn't isolate the United States. So does, you know, that gesture mean that they're going to soften their position? Do the talks over the nuclear program later in the week, do those signal a kind of willingness to engage with the Iranians, even if indirectly? Maybe, but I suspect you're going to see this sort of going back and forth. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's going to be some very, very tough language on Iran. Much of it will be focused on stuff that isn't related to the nuclear program. It's support for militias and like Hezbollah and other Shia militia throughout the region, its efforts to expand its kind of political and military power in the region. So you'll see a lot of that. But also, I expect there will be tough language on the nuclear program. But I could see it going either way.
Well, the one thing that it seems like Trump likes to get out of these, either he likes to sort of show that he's done something different from Obama, which is sort of the decertification drive, or that he's gotten some big win. He's gotten a deal. If he does not decertify, if he certifies Iran again, is there some sort of win he can declare? I mean, are there any negotiations about, for instance, the American detainees in Iran? I mean, is there something he can say, I've gotten some great deal for the U.S.?
Yeah, Richard, you got anything?
I can't see anything immediately. The French have been talking about setting up a new diplomatic process or an extension of the diplomatic process with the Iranians on, I think, issues like missile development. And it is possible that that could be gradually turned into a win that the Americans could take credit for. But to be quite honest, there's a very strong contrast in New York between the Korean and Iranian issues. On Korea, you know, most diplomats and most leaders have some sympathy for the dilemma that Trump is in. How on earth do you deal with Pyongyang? On Iran, though, there is exactly no sympathy with the U.S. position. At the moment, most observers, including U.S. allies, think that the Obama administration got a very good deal, and they are very, very nervous that over the next year we could see the deal fall apart, which would, among other things, make diplomacy in the Security Council appallingly difficult. So I don't think Trump is going to get a lot of help from other leaders on the Iranian issue this week.
Very briefly, I mean, what are the major things to look out for this week during the General Assembly? I mean, we've got Trump's speech. What are the other sort of major milestones this week?
There aren't that many. It's strange. If you go back to 2015, which was the 70th anniversary of the UN, there were big substantive issues on the table. There was a lot of talk about climate in the run-up to the final Paris summit. There was a lot of talk about development. It was 2015 that the General Assembly approved the UN's huge sustainable development goal agenda. There's nothing comparable to that this year. Now, that is partially because any diplomat with any sense realized that it would be foolish to try and have a big substantive discussion in the year of Trump, especially earlier in the year when Trump was being more aggressive towards the UN. I think everyone calculated that they just had to keep things short and sweet here. So there really are no big stories other than the president. I mean, there are lots of meetings. It's the UN General Assembly, so there are numerous boring events on minor development issues. There are a few more significant meetings. There's one on Libya that might actually be quite helpful in terms of restarting the Libyan peace process. But no, this is the Donald year, and it's all about him.
Yeah, I mean, there are the recent flare-ups like North Korea, which, you know, this GA began with another North Korean missile launch. But, you know, the Security Council recently passed a resolution imposing a lot of new sanctions on Iran, including one on the export of textiles and garments. It'll probably have a pretty, you know, serious impact on workers in that industry. But, you know, there isn't going to be a breakthrough this week. It'll be part of the, you know, everybody will probably be talking about it. They will be criticizing North Korea for, you know, violating UN Security Council resolutions that prohibit them from doing these things. But at the same time, the focus will really be on just trying to get the Americans to soften the tone on, you know, the threats of military action. Myanmar, you know, there's been a lot of frustration, a lot of activity in the UN and trying to kind of respond to the sort of massive flight of Rohingya Muslims in Burma into Bangladesh. But doesn't look like there will probably be some, you know, a lot of bilaterals, some meetings on this, but not a lot of, you know, not a big agreement on that. One of the other big things that came up was the Kurdish push for a referendum in northern Iraq. A lot of anxiety among member states, but, you know, Europeans and others have been trying to signal to the Kurds, you know, not to go ahead and do this, to, you know, focus on ensure, you know, they maintain the territorial sovereignty of the country and they kind of work out their differences with the government on, you know, appropriate autonomous, you know, autonomy kind of measures. So those are kind of interesting issues, but it's not like, you know, when, you know, Obama and Rouhani were having, like, you know, telephone conversations, like in the middle of the GA, and, you know, you had these, you know, kind of intensive discussions between Kerry and the Iranian foreign minister on a whole range of issues. So there isn't a lot of intense American, you know, diplomacy kind of going on at the UN. And I think it's kind of reflected in the fact that there aren't a lot of major initiatives coming out of the meeting.
That's interesting. And so who comes out as the big winner, Macron?
We'll see. I mean, we'll see how he handles it. I was just at the breakfast with the French foreign minister, and he was talking about how, you know, France wants to sort of position itself as sort of a balancing power, that they're looking, you know, aggressively for areas where they can sort of lead diplomatic initiatives. They have, you know, they were trying to push this idea of setting up a new contact group to sort of focus on the political transition in Syria. It was a smaller group than previous, you know, groupings of countries before, where they would have the permanent five members of the council and the, you know, regional powers participating in this effort. But it's been getting, you know, pushback from the Russians, who, you know, don't see the value for them. And the Americans are, you know, kind of having a little bit of a, you know, in the middle of a kind of bit of a pissing match with the French over whether, you know, Iran would be allowed to participate. French view, of course, is like, what's the point of doing this if the Iranians aren't part of the process? And the Americans, you know, are trying to find ways to, you know, intensify pressure on Iran. So,
and well, the last thing that we haven't really talked about is, what about Syria? Where might that, what will go on with that this week?
Syria is the ghost at the feast.
Yeah.
I think that you will hear very, very little about it.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you remember that a year ago, the dominant issue at the last General Assembly with Obama was the siege of Aleppo. The Russians massively escalated military action around the time of the General Assembly, really humiliated John Kerry, who was here in New York, by ripping up a ceasefire. And then I think either the Russians or the Syrians destroyed a UN aid convoy, sort of all as the General Assembly was coming together. It felt like the Syrian war was going to undermine the entire UN. And then Aleppo fell, Trump arrived, and after the brief flurry of activity around the chemical weapons incident and missile strikes in the spring, Syria has effectively disappeared from the UN agenda. It's a humanitarian disaster which, frankly, most diplomats and most UN officials wish they could forget. And it won't be discussed in any serious way in New York this week, which is a sad example of how fickle international diplomacy can be.
Let me end with that question then. I mean, what is the role of the UN in the era of Trump? I mean, you can just sort of have, you know, if the highest expectation out of this week is simply that Trump doesn't say anything completely outlandish, and if there's no major initiatives, I mean, where does this leave the UN?
Well, I mean, the UN is like, you know, whether they're kind of up and down in terms of how the public perceives the UN, I mean, they're a fact of life. I mean, they are integrated in every major international crisis in the world. So with, you know, maybe limited degrees of success and maybe very little success, but, you know, they are still part of the, you know, political process. If there's ever going to be a political process in Yemen, it'll be driven by the big powers, by the Saudis and others, but the UN will be playing a role in trying to provide some international legitimacy to any agreement that would come out, playing a similar role in Syria, even though their role is fairly feckless. At some point, they will have some role in, you know, helping to bring together the countries on some sort of transition. I think the Secretary General is hoping that he might have some, be able to bring some value added to efforts to resolve the political crisis in Libya. They're also, you know, they're the main game in town when you talk about humanitarian relief. So they're still the ones who are, you know, delivering supplies and food and water and all these other things that the UN provides in places like, you know, like Yemen and Syria, Somalia, South Sudan, and all these other trouble spots. So, you know, they kind of, you know, they're there and they're a central part of the way the international community deals with everything. And so the fact that they're not seen as like a major success story or not, I mean, they're still going to be, you know, plugging away.
I would differ with Colm a little bit there, because I think that is the right standard defense of the UN. And, you know, we could go on for days talking about the humanitarian crises the organization is dealing with that get very little airtime, such as Central African Republic, which is in a very bad state with UN peacekeepers on the ground. But I think the difference this year is North Korea. And it is really remarkable that, you know, here we are in the first year of Trump, the president who threatened to tank the entire UN system. And yet he is coming to the General Assembly really, really needing UN diplomacy to work over the Korean issue, because the alternative is a war. And that leaves Trump vulnerable in some ways, and it leaves him really reliant on the Security Council and on the UN on the single biggest crisis of the moment. So actually, I would say that the UN's value has come into focus for Trump and for the rest of us in the last few months, as it has become the last bulwark against a really severe escalation on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. It could be that in the next podcast, we'll be discussing exactly what Trump had to say on Tuesday. Thank you both for joining us. ER listeners, we love hearing from you. If you have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Thank you. You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Sharon Weinberger, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Katie Gardner and Brandon Martini. For more information about FP and to subscribe to the ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.